Hello and welcome to the Food Connections podcast, the podcast that connects you with the food you eat. I'm Dr. Laura Wyness, a registered nutritionist and one of Scotland's regional food tourism ambassadors. I'm interested in all things related to food and nutrition, and I love learning more about the food we eat, how it's made, and getting to know the people involved in making our food. This episode is all about beans and pulses. Dr. Pietro Iannetta is research leader at the James Hutton Institute at the Dundee campus, and he also is part of the research team at the Universidade Católica in Porto, Portugal. Dr. Iannetta heads up an agroecology research group looking at ecological food systems, which is based within the Department of Ecological Sciences. His research and innovation activities are strongly focused on the multifunctional potential of legumes, i.e. peas, beans, clover, etc. And this is because of their potential to deliver more sustainable agri-food and agri-feed systems. He is involved in numerous and quite fascinating research projects in Scotland and the UK, and also Europe-wide projects. I've included some details of these in the show notes, so do take a look. I'm delighted to speak with Dr. Iannetta about the benefits and challenges of growing beans and pulses in Scotland, how pulses fit into our diet, and if we'll be seeing Scottish-grown baked beans on the supermarket shelves soon. I hope you enjoy listening. So I'm delighted to be joined today by Dr. Pietro Iannetta, or Pete, as I've also been told he likes to be called. So, thank you for joining me today on the Food Connections podcast.
Well, thank you, Laura.
And I am really excited to speak to you today about pulses. And in the UK, we eat fewer pulses than average around the world, which is a shame because pulses are really useful to include more of in the diet, as they do provide a healthy balance of protein and fibres and other beneficial nutrients. And also they are quite a fascinating plant. So, Pete, can you first of all share how you got into plant research, or rather how you became an agroecologist, and maybe also what that actually means?
Goodness, that's three questions.
Well, sorry.
The first one, I went originally to study marine biology at St Andrews and changed my final year from marine to plant biology and ecology. And that was on the back of one chance meeting with a professor from Dundee University called Professor Janet Sprent, who's well known in circles concerning legumes and peas and beans for her expertise in biological nitrogen fixation. So she quite impressed me because, generally the industrialized food systems of the West hadn't cottoned on to peas and beans. So most of the people she was working with then were in Africa and Asia and South America, and focusing on issues of food and environmental security, or nutrition and environmental security. So this was just really on the back of, Live Aid, if you remember Live Aid.
Yeah.
That was quite topical at the time. So I met this lady I must have been about 19 at the time, and went, yes, I like you. And I went to work for her over the summers. And consequently, when I finished my degree, cutting a long story short, I was able to secure a PhD in her lab.
Brilliant. And you now are involved in quite a few research studies at James Hutton Institute. Do you want to maybe give a flavour of some of the research you've been involved in
Goodness.
Over the years?
Yes, a very quick flavour. So we work on everything really from there's this bacteria called rhizobia that live in the soil, and they form an association with these peas and beans. And it's these bacteria that fix the nitrogen from the air in exchange for sugar, photosynthate from the plant. So that's a symbiosis. So we work on everything from the rhizobia and the molecular diversity around the roots, all the way through to working with stakeholders and actors in the value chain to devise policies to see more sustainable food systems, well, legume-based food systems, of course. So, we do an awful lot of work with quite a number of projects running in parallel.
So it's looking at the whole food system, really, and how it works.
Yeah, and that's the way it's developed. And really, historically, I'm a biologist, looking at how biological nitrogen fixation is done, how these plants can take nitrogen from the air and turn it into biologically useful nitrogen like protein. And whatnot. But over the course of my career, that's really ballooned into something, you know, far, far bigger. So within the agroecology group, I head up a small team called Ecological Food Systems, but these are really legume-based food systems. And hence, that's really how I became an agroecologist. I mean, historically, agroecology is the study of the ecology of the tilled system, the farm system, but nowadays it's far bigger than that. It involves not just the food system, but how society organizes itself to deliver food and environmental security. So it's quite a complex, you know, range of things. It involves culture and history, and it's really quite involved.
Yeah, and I can imagine, yeah, as you say, it's complex and maybe has changed over the last couple of years as well, and lots of different factors impacting
Absolutely, yeah. I mean,
it.
certainly, I shouldn't say it, but there's nothing quite like a food security crisis and a global pandemic, and then war in the Ukraine and climate change. So there's definitely a perfect storm, if you like, of factors that, you know, that hopefully will get us to pull our socks up.
Yeah. I initially actually got in contact with you as I'd read about the work you've been doing on fava beans and potentially helping develop Scottish grown baked beans, which I do want to ask you about in more detail later on. But for now, I wanted to ask you about your work on beans and legumes in general, and perhaps if you could first clarify what these terms actually mean. What's the difference between a pulse and a bean and a legume?
Well, it's certainly good to talk about what I like to talk about is what legumes' point of difference is. And many people don't know really what you mean when you talk about a legume. Of course, we've mentioned it already, touched upon the fact that it's peas and beans, but it's also, so these are grain crops that are generally grown for their grains, the high protein grains, but they're also high starch grains. But also there are the forage legumes, which are often fed to cattle, for example, clover. There's other types as well, lotus, lucerne. And there are woody legumes as well that we tend to forget about. Well, they don't have a role in the crop system, they have a role on the edges of the crop system. And these can be things like gorse and broom, which are nitrogen-fixing woody legumes. So there's quite a diverse range of types with a diverse range of functions. Even for the woody legumes like gorse and broom, they were used as bedding, for example, and even forage broom historically. But you're going back to your question about you know what is a legume and its point of difference. It's the fact that it needs no nitrogen, no mineral nitrogen, no man-made nitrogen, no synthetic nitrogen to exist. It can meet its nitrogen needs from the air, by virtue of this symbiosis with the bacteria I've already talked about, this rhizobia. So that's what sets legumes apart. They don't need mineral nitrogen. You know, on top of that, you have these subdivisions of the classification, which is some people will refer to them as pulses. But pulses is one type of the grain types of legumes. So fava bean or field beans, which includes broad beans, peas, lentils. These are what we call pulses, or I would call a pulse. That is, they don't have oil in them. They're just protein carbohydrate provision. Whereas if you look at other crops like soybean, peanut, lupin, I wouldn't call those pulses. I'd call those, they're all allaginous grains. They all contain oil. So they will have some starch, but they contain a significant amount of oil. And that actually makes a difference as to how you treat and store those. Because the pulses can store far longer than the oil-containing legume grains, because they generally have to process because the oil often oxidizes. So pulses are great because you can store them. You can put them away for a rainy day if you like. You know, many years ago it was quite normal to store peas and beans for those events when you might have a crop failure, and you could still, you know, as part of your food security plan, is to store these starch-only containing grains. And of course, the forage legumes as well, as well as feeding animals, they can be used as manures, green manures, or even brown manures. They can be killed and then ploughed in. You can even use them as living manures, which means you cut them and let them grow again, and continue to cut them and keep putting their goodness back into the soil. So, and what they put into the soil, of course, isn't just a nitrogen provision. We can get caught up in very simple classifications of legumes being fertilizer for free or protein, but actually the provisions they make are much greater. They're important resources for pollinators, for example, and the residues that they return to the soil are far more than just nitrogen-rich material biomass. They're rich in many secondary metabolites and other factors as well that can affect soil function.
Wow, so quite a super bean or a super legume. Yeah, it sounds like they have a number of different factors, very positive factors. Of course, nutritionally speaking, they are, of course, very low in fat and provide a healthy mix of protein and fiber, as well as a range of useful vitamins and minerals, which I mentioned earlier. So things like iron and folate, potassium, zinc, and of course, antioxidants as well, lots of plant-based beneficial compounds.
And a great source of fiber too, of course. Fibers, back on the agenda again. I see it cycle
Yeah.
through research, funding fashions, but hopefully it will be here to stay.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think they're one of the highest fiber foods. So, like a portion of pulses, a portion is about 3 heaped tablespoons, would provide about a third of your recommended daily fiber. So, yeah, we all definitely need to have more fiber in the diet. So, pulses are a great way to get more fiber in.
And people forget peanuts are part of that as well.
Oh.
They're a legume, and
Yeah.
people don't seem to think about it. Yeah, it's widely accepted, of course, as well. Great source of fiber and pure protein and other secondary metabolites and whatnot.
Yeah, absolutely. And because of all these beneficial fibers and the nutrition profile, they are very useful health-wise. So they're very heart healthy. So they help lower cholesterol levels, they control blood sugar levels, and have been useful to help manage weight as well. So a good all-round food to include more of. And one of the projects I've been doing in my role as food tourism ambassador is developing a Scottish version of the UK's Eat Well Guide. And the Eat Well Guide shows how much of what we eat overall should come from each food group to achieve a healthy, balanced diet. And it's interesting to see where pulses are placed within the guide, whether they should go in the fruit and veg section, because they are classed as one of your 5 a day, or is it the carbohydrate section, or is it the protein section? Because they do have kind of attributes
Absolutely,
in all.
absolutely. Yeah, pulses don't form into this Victorian classification,
Yeah.
and really, that's that. It's one thing to have a classification, but we have to realize what its limitations are. But certainly, it's one of my bugbears is the extent to which, I've talked already about how legumes are perceived as a fertilizer replacement, if you like, and people talk about them as a meat substitute, and that really annoys me no end because. Pulses are not a meat substitute. They are pulses. They're legumes, and they do what they do. And I think it's about time they stood apart. Quite often, if you go to the, went to wholesalers, like you have the same issue that you talk about. You don't know where to find legumes. Are they in the vegetable section? They might be in the protein section. Sometimes you might even find them in the meat section, and that drives me nuts, if you pardon the pun. But I think they deserve a category of their own. I see it even in advertising. I've seen another term I particularly dislike is grass-fed beef. You don't feed beef anyway, you feed cattle, but that's maybe yeah, and you don't feed cattle just grass. They wouldn't be very healthy if you fed them just grass. These are grass, usually clover-fed or maybe lucerne, but they're certainly forage legume-fed animals, and it's often the case to me. It seems that legumes are written out of the marketing spin, and I think that's a huge educational loss on the back of that. I even wondered whether I should write a letter or a small popular article about food discrimination. We touched on this,
Yeah.
in our chats before we had this interview, but they to me, it's certainly real, and I
Yeah.
see legumes being marginalised in classification, various classifications and marketing spin, and it's a great annoyance to me.
Yeah, I think that's a great idea, actually, just highlighting just how important pulses are and talking more about them and having their own category. Or I suppose if we talk about them more, then people are more likely to think of them when they go to the supermarket and maybe buy them and actually eat them.
I think so. Absolutely. Yeah. I can tell you, if you hear people talking about, you know, meat substitute or fertilizer replacement, just, yeah, you can help me. Just say, whoa, just whoa.
Yeah. Well, can we kind of get on to the kind of growing of pulses now? And do we grow a lot of pulses in Scotland, or, you know, what are the benefits of growing pulses in Scotland?
So we should be growing a lot more pulses. I mean, I've put my agroecological hat on. I'd like to see somewhere like 15 to 25% of the rotation being pulses.
Mm-hmm.
Achieving 25 would be quite difficult in Scotland or the UK. Easier in England, perhaps, than Scotland, just because of the weather difference. Peas and beans tend only to be grown in Scotland. They're genetically very similar.
Mm-hmm.
So generally, if you crop a pea or a bean, you wouldn't crop another one for 6 years. So without further diversification of the grain legumes that we grow in Scotland, probably one in six is about as much as we can hope for peas and beans. But if we can introduce lupin, you know, and soybean and lentils, then we could hit, to me, that magic 25% inclusion mark. And agroecologically, we've shown that, you know, that can maximise productivity while minimising synthetic fertiliser use. So that would definitely be a target.
Mm-hmm.
England already have a history of growing, you know, some soybeans, some lentils. So there's more hope, you know, for that sort of thing. But on top of that, we've got climate change. So that's another confounding factor. So while the weather is getting warmer, and in theory we can start cropping soybeans, you know, in Scotland, we've had a soybean grain crop at the James Sutton Institute already. The reality is that the climate change causes stochastic weather, and while on average we are warmer, it's mixed up by the fact that we can have a long winter with frost going on till May, and very cold weather and very wet weather, and the weather's quite mixed up. So that's another complication when it comes to any crop, never mind legumes. Is keeping the production resilient with the stochastic weather effects of climate change.
That's definitely a new term that I heard, the stochastic weather, because you were saying global warming maybe doesn't give it justice, or doesn't describe it well enough. Is that?
Well, I guess as a scientist, I'm a bit too much of a pedant, but I do find that words are important, and many members of the general public, I feel, are cottoned on to this fact that we're in a global warming situation, and that is correct. But that doesn't mean we're just getting warmer. It's warmer and more stochastic weather. You know, so it's a complicated arena we're living in at the moment.
Yeah, so more variable weather gives a bigger headache for farmers, knowing what to plant or when to crop, when to harvest.
Absolutely, and getting crop rotations designed cleverly and management practices that can allow you some resilience to your yields is important. It's not as simple as putting a crop in. There's a whole environment to be managed to try and realise resilience.
Absolutely. And of course, including the legumes in the rotation would help with the soil quality and plant diversity as well.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, and we've got a project that's just started, funded by DEFRA, the Nitrogen Climate Smart Project, and we're trying to get better numbers for those benefits. So while we know we don't have to put, you know, fertilizer in when we have a legume, we're not. We'd like to be more knowledgeable with respect to what the benefits are to the wider rotation and the soil qualities and the greenhouse gas evolution rate. So there's some data out there, but we've got a large network as part of that project where we're working very closely with farmers to get real world data, not just from farmers, but also from long-term experimental platforms. We've got one at the James Sutton Institute, for example. It's a fava bean based rotation. We also have a clover understory to our cereal crops there as well. So to getting better numbers is important, but absolutely, I mean, legumes, if you get a very big crop of something like fava bean, you can have something like, you know, at the very most 100 kilograms of nitrogen going back into the rotation. So making sure that's captured is important. So it's not just offering the use of the crop itself. You need to have a catch crop as well after the legume. Whether that's another crop or whether that's a mixture of forage type of crops to soak up that nitrogen. It's very quickly mineralized.
Okay. So a good catch crop would be what, like potatoes or something, or
it could no, I wouldn't say it's so much potatoes. Generally, a catch crop would go in the winter or the autumn,
oh, okay.
just after the pulse is harvested, and it could be a mixture of it could be really very complex things of brassicas, grasses, maybe even some more forage legume types. But there's lots of that's another area of science is
okay.
cover mixtures, because as well it can be part of an integrated pest management plan. So as well as capturing these nitrogen-rich residues as they're mineralized, keeping that benefit in the field, you can also have plants deliver chemicals that suppress diseases as well.
Okay.
So you can minimize pesticide use. So part of the story as well is crop system, what we call crop diversification. We actually crop very few crops. So growing more crops helps diversify the crop system, helps with disease control, also helps diversify the value chain and the number of products we have for sale as well. So that again, you could ally your environmental resilience that you're trying to build with your economic resilience through more and more diverse value chains.
Yeah.
There's a whole lot of questions we have regarding all these residues that go back into the soil. And the extent to which they might be able to help with carbon sequestration in the soil. Farmers, are getting much more aware of the soil qualities and soil functions, realizing that intensive agriculture has driven the system generally to lower the carbon content of soil, and that's made the soil less resilient. So having different means to keep the carbon content of the soil high. And there's different, again, it's another area of science. There's different forms of carbon. There's short-lived carbon, there's long-lived carbon, but really we want this long-lived carbon in the soil. That would be ideal.
Okay. Gosh, it does sound quite complex when you get into it. What are the challenges then of growing more beans and pulses in Scotland, and why are farmers maybe not growing so much at the moment?
Ultimately, it's about market. At the end of the last time we did the survey, pulses were cropped on around about 1% of the ground, which, and mainly where they were cropped, they're cropped on mixed farms. That is farms that grow crops and animals. And they grow those peas or beans on the whole to feed, to have on-farm protein supply for their farmed animals. Allied to that, you have a small amount of growers growing beans for the human food market, but ironically, it's not the human food market in Scotland.
Okay, exported.
It's exported mainly to North Africa. We in Scotland don't suffer a brookid beetle, which is a bug that leaves a hole in the seed. It has started creeping into Scotland. It is moving north, but it's not too bad on this, compared to the scale of its incidence in England. But that can certainly lower a crop's quality and render it only useful for animal feed processes. Whereas in Scotland, we do have the potential in a good year. But there are, we have another issue in Scotland, which is damp weather.
Right, yeah.
That brings with it, other diseases like chocolate spot and whatnot that are a problem to the crop quality as well. But, and the other thing is that beans, particularly fava beans, take a long time to mature. And if the winter closes in too fast, it can sometimes be very difficult to get the crop dried up and out the ground. So, there's an interest in having shorter cycling, that is a crop that matures more quickly and is harvestable, in a shorter time frame.
Okay.
Especially for fava beans, peas much more widely accepted in Scotland. They have a shorter lifespan, shorter life cycle. They can generally come out about August time, and you usually can get a crop in on the back of them. Behind peas, beans, another challenge. And to avoid the value of those residues during loss, I'd like to see more experiments with, particularly with fava beans, with an understory of some kind. so that once they're harvested, the understory can soak up the residues once they mineralize. I think that would help keep the
Okay.
benefits in the field.
Yeah. And you said, I'm quite shocked at this, only 1% of crops grown here are actually legumes, and most of that is probably for animal feeds.
Most of our rotation is actually not food at all. It's
Wow.
mainly feed, whether it's for biofuel, anaerobic digestion, beer,
Yeah. Okay.
whiskey, animal feed. So again, it's back to semantics. It's funny that people talk about food security in a food system, whereas
Yeah.
really most of the time we're talking about feed security, and
Okay.
not actual food security when we're talking about crop production.
There's a huge scope to increase that number then.
Oh yeah, I mean for sure we've certainly seen a number of countries around the world, particularly on the back of the Ukraine war, looking to increase their level of food self-sufficiency. That's not to say we shouldn't be importing food. I mean, there's some things we have to import, like bananas, pomegranates, or whatever it happens to be. But I do believe that food imports are an important part of what I call the food security equation. It's good to have that door open. But I think the balance is skewed, and I'd certainly like to see the other levels of food imports being drastically reduced. Moreover, it's a massive industry that we're missing out on. If we're importing, that's yeah, it has value, and it means that we're not generating our own products in that marketplace, so we won't benefit from those sales. So I think we could be, we can do high quality peas and beans in the UK, and I'd like to see more of it. And I'm sure they'll be very attractive to many other countries around the world if we can do that, not just domestically, to increase our food consumption. But another problem why we aren't cropping more is our value chain outside the farm gate is not particularly well structured. We don't have processing capacities. So you need to be able to crop your bean or pea, and if you're going to put it into the food market, you need to get it to human food grade. You might need to de-hull it. You might need to mill it. You might need to fractionate it into, because there are methods to enrich the protein or enrich the starch components. The hull has a separate value, so quite often the components of the bean, once they're separated, are worth more than the bean itself as a whole grain.
Okay.
So, but we don't have really very good processing capacities ex farm gate. I'm seeing more farmers starting to invest in on-farm processing equipment, which is great, mainly to feed their animals, but with a very small change or addition to their processing chain within the farm, they could start producing food grade beans, and they could be operating their own short value chain direct to consumers from the farm, for example. So I'm
Yeah.
seeing those sorts of things take hold now, particularly as we've seen fuel prices going up, which means fertilizer prices going up, which means feed prices go up.
Yeah.
I talked to an organic farmer not too long ago who was telling me if he wanted organic feed, soybeans imported, he'd have to pay about £1,000 to £1,200 for a ton. I mean, maybe that price has come down now, I don't know, but it's still
Wow.
pretty high. That's the kind of prices that put farmers out of business. So, but that's created a pressure for self-sufficiency, which is a good thing. And really, quite often, what we're doing, especially the feed industry, who are the biggest users of beans, we're competing with soybean. So another part of this processing, mindset, on-farm processing mindset, is certainly taking hold. I mentioned this NCS project, Nitrogen Climate Smart Project. Well, that project looks at the greenhouse gas footprint of farms. Now, when you're importing soybeans, your greenhouse gas footprint goes up enormously. So if you can be processing your peas and beans on farm, perhaps combining them with complementing them with cereal grains, for example, and processing them in a particular way to match the provision made by soybean, then you don't have to import those soybeans anymore. So home growing your feed and not importing soybeans is a huge greenhouse gas win. And that in itself, beyond the nice cropping effects in the field and whatnot, just sourcing those homegrown peas and beans for a domestic animal feed supply would be great. You
Yeah,
know,
a huge,
that would
huge
transform
bonus.
our carbon footprint.
Interesting. Okay. Well, of course, in the UK, we mainly eat baked beans is the most commonly one, commonly eaten bean. And I think we eat more than 2 million cans of baked beans every day. And I did mention at the start that you've been involved in some work to develop a Scottish grown baked bean. So can you explain a bit more about that and how that came about, or how close are we to actually having a can of Scottish grown baked beans available in the supermarkets?
Right. Okay. Let's talk about baked beans a little first. So baked beans themselves are great food. The navy beans or haricot beans. We do have a couple of UK varieties now. There's a professor Eric Hollop from Warwick University is now working on a couple of types that he bred and is trialling in England. So that's something to look out for. Haricot beans to me, with my put my biologist hat on, are particularly interesting because they're common beans. They're Phaseolus vulgaris, and they don't fix especially well compared to crops like fava bean. Usually, a commercial crop takes around about 50 kilograms of nitrogen per hectare, so around about half the amount that you might apply to a barley or a wheat. So while that's good, that is a reduction. It's not mineral nitrogen free quite often. Of course, if they're grown organically, they would be mineral nitrogen free. Nobody would use synthetic fertilizer on an organic farm. If they're grown on a conventional farm, usually the kind of beans we have are imported from places like Canada. They would be fertilized. So academically, that's of interest to me, is why don't common beans, haricot beans, fix like fava bean does. So now I'm going to go into the Scottish bean. The Scottish bean, or I call it Henry Taylor Scottish bean, was bred by a field trials officer in the 60s and 70s at the James Hutton Institute. He retired, kept breeding the beans in his back garden in his spare time, and gifted those back to the Institute. So he bred, it's a dwarf fava bean. It's short cycling. It ripens around about the time frame of a pea. Because it's a dwarf bean, it doesn't grow as as tall as modern conventional beans. It doesn't yield as much. But he bred it as an eating bean, so he's bred it to have a thin coat, to be low tannin, not to be bitter. So it is a nice bean. It's about the same size as a pea as well. It cooks quickly. It takes no synthetic nitrogen, so it's very different from the traditional bean that you'd find in a baked bean can. So it looks a bit more like a pea, if you like. And we've cooked it, we've made baked beans with it, it works very well. We've got a terrific sauce. How close are we to producing it commercially? Pretty close, actually. The barrier at the moment is the cost, especially now fuel prices have gone up and canning prices have gone up. So because it's not produced on a massive scale, the cost is higher. Also, it may be that if we went to a Tetra Pak, then that might it will improve certainly its sustainability rating. But we have a lot of data on the bean ready to go when it is marketed. It's about finding an affordable way of putting it in a can. Your baked beans themselves are produced on a massive scale, and they are. Yeah, the cost will be very difficult to compete with. But nevertheless, I could see this being a premium product, a bespoke product. And it was developed by Henry Taylor in the 70s. There was another lady then called working with them called Greta Priestley. She also developed two haricot bean types, so these Phaseolus types, actually three types, and we're growing them again at the Institute. So these look far more like a traditional baked bean, probably a little larger. Should be very good eating beans. So we're in the process of bulking up those as well, and they could equally be commercial too. So we have had companies that are interested, like Glasgow Locavore, and like Hodma Dodds. People would know these companies if they're into green food and pulses in the UK. But it is this issue of energy prices and just waiting for that to be right. But we have an organic farmer who's licensed to produce Henry Taylor's Scottish bean at the moment. And the hope is that he produced these Scottish bread common beans as well. They were called Glencairs and Glenlyon and Glams.
Good Scottish names.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I'll look out for that in future. Yeah, definitely. I would definitely want to taste the beans if you're saying that they are tasty in the trials that you've done and it's a possibility. So hopefully they'll be on shelves.
Well, we trialed them with, I better not say which retailer it was, but we did a proper taste trial and they rated just the same as baked beans from a popular retailer.
Very good. Well, that is impressive. And you mentioned obviously fava beans, which sound amazing as a type of bean that can be grown here. And obviously it sounds like quite an underutilized crop as well. And we've spoken about the importance of having a diverse range of crops, which, as you said, is good for the soil diversity and also for the diversity in our diet as well, more choice. Some of your research has been looking at underutilized crops. So what do you feel could or should be grown more in Scotland that would help add that diversity to our diet? Or is that just too difficult a question?
No, there's just so many things that we could be growing. I mean, nuts, fruit.
Nuts. Do we grow nuts in Scotland?
You can grow walnuts, you can grow hazelnuts, for example.
Okay.
We should be doing a lot more fruit.
Yeah. What type of fruit? Apples, pears?
Traditionally, there's all the usual soft fruits, strawberries, raspberries, blueberries, but you've also got honeyberries now that are proving new and quite popular. But, you know, we've also been good on top fruit, so plums, cherries, you know, we can do apples. So I think we should be re-immersing ourselves in our Scottish food culture and enjoying it. You know, it's great. I mean, I'm all for quality meat and quality fish, but we could be doing a lot more of homegrown fruit and veg. You know, why we're importing so many apples is especially from New Zealand, for example. We can grow, you know, apples perfectly well. I mean, you could have other industries linked to that. You can start then branching out into perhaps cultural desserts and the cider, of course, and you know, the list can go on and on. But certainly, you know, fruit alongside pulses, fruit, nuts, veg, you know, must feature highly. And these were all in the, you'll probably know about this, the Eat Well Guide that was recommended by the Eat Lancet Commission. We know that a diverse diet high in fibre, you know, is one of the best routes towards living longer. It's no guarantee of long life, but there's genetic factors there as well, of course. But it, regardless of how long you live, it improves life quality. So it isn't simply about living longer; it's about living better as well. So I think we forget the quality aspects to the discussion. I see people talking about living longer, and terrific if you can, but there's no point living longer if your life quality is poor. So I think we should talk more about quality.
Yeah, having a diverse range of foods in your diet as well makes it more interesting as well. I often talk about mindful eating and the enjoyment of food, and food is so much more than just nutrients, and I say that as a nutritionist, but it's more about the enjoyment and the social aspect and the taste, obviously. So it's a whole experience. So
I can't agree with you more. There's a bigger picture there.
So many benefits to legumes and all the underutilized crops that we could be growing here. Just to finish off, do you often have beans or peas on your menu at home?
Yes. my wife particularly likes pulses as well. So I sometimes wonder why I ended up in this arena, and you wonder subconsciously what might have had an influence over the years from growing up. But you know, as the name indicates, my parentage is not Scottish. So my mother's from Sorrento, my father's family from the middle of Italy, a place called Belmonte, Monte Cassino. So certainly, you know, Italy is a food culture, you know, and that food is embedded in family. So you know, my simple recipe is dead simple. You know, I love one of my favorite dishes is pasta arrabbiata, which usually is just tomatoes and chili. But if you run some beans through there as well, you know, that could be any kind. It could be lentils, it could be pinto black beans, it could be any kind of bean. But certainly that's my personal favourite, you know, olive oil, a light chili tomato with beans. But my mother often used to have a cold pasta salad with beans. Yeah, that was something we'd commonly have. And instead of saying buon appetito, she'd say buona fagioli. And that was a common, you know, I think she would say commonly. And of course, well, nutritionally, you know how complementary cereals and beans are together in terms of their protein complement.
Yeah, complementary amino acids.
As well as the starch, you know, the nature of the starches as well, and the fiber that's there too. And I believe, you could correct me, I'm not a nutritionist, I believe that once you, so bean starch is resistant starch, is the kind of starch that degrades slowly and releases its energy, you know, over a period. I've heard that cereal starches, once it's cooked and cooled, have the same effect.
Yeah, so, and increases the resistant starch if you cook pasta and cool it and then have it cold. Yeah, which is
a cold pasta salad.
Yeah, very good. And so, like you say, there's so many different ways to have beans as well in dishes. So I was looking up you mentioned it earlier, the Hodmidod company. They've got a great website with lots of recipes on their website of how to use beans. So I was looking through them, and there's things like fava bean, ginger and sweet potato cake, and a fava bean biryani, which definitely sounds nice. But
Hodmidod are doing great things, not just in, of course, having products available to the public, but I think their outreach and public education is fantastic as well. So I can't, you can only commend that initiative. Going back to the baked beans, I sometimes wonder whether we shouldn't, maybe have a nod to modern Scottish culture, and maybe have a tikka masala baked bean.
Yeah. Was that not invented in Scotland?
Tikka masala. I believe so. Yeah. So why don't we combine the two? I've been in a curry sauce as a winner as well. I sometimes do that. Yeah.
Absolutely. Okay. Well, definitely so much scope for different recipes and flavors and ways to enjoy beans. Well, thank you so much for your insight. It has been absolutely fascinating, and hopefully has raised the profile a little bit more of legumes and pulses and beans, and getting people thinking about them more and eating them more.
Well, thank you, Laura. Thanks for your interest. Cheers.
Brilliant. Thanks. Thanks for listening to this Food Connections podcast. Do check out the show notes for some useful links related to this episode. If you enjoyed this episode, I'd love it if you could give it a rating and leave a short review. It means so much. And please do spread the word and tell others about it. If you have any comments or suggestions for future guests, do get in touch. Thanks again for listening, and see you next time.